This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello and welcome to The Bunker. I'm Seth Tavel. Do you remember strong and stable leadership under Theresa May, not a coalition of chaos between Labour and the SNP? It didn't exactly go to plan. A recent ranking of all the British Prime Ministers put Theresa May at number 50 out of 55. But since then, we've had at least two worst Prime Ministers of all time, so have we forgotten just how bad Theresa May was? Here to shed some light on this is Tim Bale. Tim is Professor of Politics at Queen Mary, University of London, and is prolific in writing on political topics including both Labour and the Conservatives, as well as elections. He also tweets a lot. His latest book is The Conservative Party After Brexit, Turmoil and Transformation. Tim, welcome to The Bunker.
Hi there. I'm just laughing at you saying he tweets a lot. I think that means too much. But anyway, thanks for having me.
Delighted. Tim, have I wronged her in my introduction? Was Theresa May an underestimated great prime minister?
I don't think she was ever destined to be a great prime minister. I do think, however, it's fair to say, and probably fair to her, to say that she did inherit some very, very difficult circumstances and, of course, a very difficult parliamentary party, and in particular, a few figures who were absolutely desperate to take over the leadership from her almost as soon as she'd taken over, particularly after the 2017 election, which we can talk about a bit later. So I'm not so sure that in the future, historians will be quite as condemnatory as some people have been recently.
Why is that?
Well, I mean, it's partly, as I say, because, circumstances, I think, did combine to make it very, very difficult for her. I also think there's an extent to which she was, although clearly the decision was ultimately hers, pressured into holding an early general election, which in some ways is key to quite why her premiership collapsed in such ignominy over the preceding 18 months or so. I think, she did, certainly in comparison to the two other figures that you've mentioned, if not explicitly, and I assume we're talking about Boris Johnson and Liz Truss there, actually do the work in the sense that, she was pretty conscientious, and nor was she necessarily much of an ideologue either, and not completely obsessed with her image. So, some of the strengths that I think she had would have been useful as a prime minister in any other circumstance. It's just that, as I say, the circumstances were pretty terrible. That's not to deny that, some of the problems were of her own making. I think to say that, she was an absolute disaster and destined to be an absolute disaster would be wrong.
So let's look maybe a bit at her preparation, because she'd been at the top of Tory politics for a very long time. She'd been a frontbencher since the early 2000s. She'd been Home Secretary, one of the great offices of state, for 6 years before becoming Prime Minister. Wasn't she arguably one of the most experienced people in recent years to become PM?
Yes, I think that is a good point. I mean, one could argue that perhaps, however, that experience was rather limited in the sense that she'd spent an awful long time at the Home Office. And as a result, I think, came to see politics through the prism of that particular role. And I think that also meant that she saw the Brexit referendum result through the prism of immigration, which was, of course, her big obsession during her time as a Home Secretary. And that, I think, led her rather sooner than should have been the case, I think, to talk about a hard Brexit and leaving the single market in particular, because in order to end freedom of movement, that was something that we had to do. So I think that was a problem. I think also clearly, she took with her from the Home Office the two advisors that she'd had there, who I think did a, you know, sterling job for her at the Home Office, but weren't necessarily the right people to be in charge in Downing Street. And we're talking there about Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill, for, you know, both have considerable strengths, but arguably in terms of their interaction with other people within the government and indeed the civil service, you know, perhaps created more problems for Theresa May than they solved.
And was that one of the main failings then, the difficulty of working in government or across different departments rather than just within the Home Office?
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I think, you know, while I wouldn't accuse Theresa May of having tunnel vision, I think she is one of those people who, you know, likes to concentrate on one thing at a time. So therefore found it quite difficult to balance all the things that necessarily hit a prime minister simultaneously. And also I would suggest that, you know, without necessarily being a control freak, she is someone who actually likes to be in control of things and probably also likes to make decisions rather meticulously. And that's, I think, something that's quite difficult to do when you're a prime minister. You have to admit to some extent that you have lost a certain degree of control and that you have to act on the hoof. And I just don't think that's Theresa May's style and certainly her style of government.
Let's talk about the 2017 snap election. It was a real gamble and it was a turning point to her premiership. Until that point, she really seemed to have sort of Midas touch. I remember, you know, the image that she was the woman who promised to crush the saboteurs. And afterwards, it seemed like she couldn't do anything right. Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, I do think, and clearly, you know, there was a massive loss of authority as a result of losing that election. And, you know, there were good reasons in some ways to go for that election, as many people were arguing. She did have, you know, a relatively tight majority. And certainly if she wanted to get a particular version of Brexit through the parliamentary party, then it was clear that she was probably going to have to burn off a few Brexit ultras in doing that, and perhaps actually also some soft Brexiteers. So, you know, more of a majority would have given her more of a cushion. So, you know, one can see why she was persuaded to do it. But on the other hand, and you know, this comes over in the book because of, you know, some interviews that I did and some documents that I saw, that actually the research was pointing pretty clearly to the fact that voters themselves weren't keen on having an election and didn't really see that as a justification for one. They really just wanted her to get on with the job of delivering Brexit. They didn't want her to waste any time with an election of doing that. And voters, you know, were already quite concerned about the uncertainty that Brexit had created and felt that an election would simply increase that. And the research also showed that actually quite a lot of the Conservative vote was quite soft. Mm-hmm. And, you know, warned her that, you know, there was a danger that people might, you know, flip over to the Labour Party, particularly because, and again, this was something that came out of the research, people thought that the election was a done deal for the Conservatives, so didn't really see much danger in voting for a Labour MP and getting a Conservative government. So that was a problem. And also, to be honest, you know, many of the people advising her weren't as familiar with her as a politician than they might have been, and therefore thought that she could handle a more kind of leadership-focused general election. You may remember it was very leadership-focused. It was Theresa May's Conservatives. You know, it was her signature on the you know the bus. You know, all the candidates were photographed with her. It was very much a kind of presidential election. But you know, Theresa May's campaigning skills simply weren't up to that kind of campaign. So there was a problem there. As well as all the mistakes made in the election campaign itself.
I remember a very dramatic example of that, which was a video that the Conservatives made, and it was technically brilliant in that what it did is it had national messages given to you by Theresa May, and then you'd cut to her at a different angle, and she'd tell you about your local candidate and how brilliant they were in your area. But by the time she's filmed 600 of these for every constituency in the UK, she looks exhausted. I mean, most people would be. But it was a case where the technology was there, the targeting was there, you know, the online campaigning was there, but the actual content, the showmanship, as it were, wasn't authentic.
No, and I do think she really struggled. And another sort of clip that people may remember, which, you know, really did go viral, was when, you know, she changed the policy on the so-called dementia tax on the hoof because it was going down so badly. And yet she insisted, nothing has changed, nothing has changed. And I think that really caused her a problem, as did her reply. I think it was to a nurse who was talking about You know, the need for more funding in the NHS and, you know, to pay nurses more. And, you know, she rather patronisingly said, you know, there's no magic money tree out there. And that really, you know, contradicted in some ways the whole thrust of the Conservative campaign, which was, you know, ending austerity. Mm. So there were mixed messages going on there, delivered by someone who, you know, really, you know, wasn't capable of delivering them as effectively as I think most, you know, leaders of political parties normally are. And then, of course, you know, classically, and this has happened before in Conservative election campaigns, it wasn't exactly clear who was running the campaign. You know, there were differences between Nick Timothy and Fiona Hill on the one hand, and those who were rather disparagingly on occasions referred to as the Australians on the other.
And that U-turn in particular, I mean, I don't want to exaggerate just one particular moment, but it did seem to be the tipping point of the campaign. I wonder if up until that point, people felt they knew what they were getting with Theresa May. She wasn't a slick showman in the way that Tony Blair or David Cameron was, but she was a policy wonk. She was somebody who delivered in government. And this seemed to be something where her main strength, you know, delivering policy, even that was suddenly in doubt.
Yes, I think that's a very good point. You know, if you are running a campaign which emphasises the fact that your leader is strong and stable, suddenly to do this, you know, this embarrassing switcheroo in the middle of the campaign does rather cast doubt upon that particular quality. So, yes, I think you've got a very good point there. But as you say, I mean, there were other things, you know, in the Conservative manifesto that didn't go down very well. One that many people won't remember, but actually does seem to have made quite a lot of difference to voters, or at least some voters anyway, was the idea that the Conservatives might reintroduce hunting with dogs, you know, which went really viral on social media, sort of under the radar in some senses of the broadcasters and the national newspapers, but does seem to have impacted on quite a lot of voters, judging by some of the research.
So was she very much defined by having a minority government, really, for the rest of the 2 years or so that she was prime minister?
Yeah, I mean, that wouldn't have been so bad if she'd been running a minority government on behalf of a Conservative Party that was united. But of course, the Conservative Party was then very, very badly divided, partly because the Brexit ultras on the Conservative side realised that they could use the fact that she, you know, didn't have any kind of cushion as leverage over her. And therefore, you know, to use it as a way of gaining an even harder Brexit than she had first suggested, so that, you know, any attempt by her to compromise with the European Union and get some kind of deal, you know, first of all on Northern Ireland, most obviously, could be defeated by them quite easily in Parliament, particularly obviously because Labour weren't inclined to give her any kind of cross-party support. And actually, she wasn't inclined to ask Labour for any cross-party support because whatever you think about Theresa May, she's a very tribal conservative. So she had absolutely no intention whatsoever of doing a deal, particularly with someone like Jeremy Corbyn. So she was caught really between, you know, a rock and a hard place, you know, the devil in the deep blue sea, however you want to put it.
And on that tribalism, one of the things that comes across very clearly in your book is this huge change to the Conservative Party over the last 7 years or so, from this traditional party grounded in ideas and interests to a sort of Brexit cult. How much was Theresa May a help or a hindrance to that?
Well, I mean, I think that is an interesting question. I mean, I think had Theresa May thought a little bit more about the kind of Brexit that she wanted when she first became Prime Minister and hadn't immediately gone for this kind of hard Brexit, she might well have been able to sell a slightly softer Brexit to both her parliamentary party and indeed, you know, voters as a whole. I think, you know, once she came down in favour of a hard Brexit, then it was always going to be the case that, you know, the Brexit ultras in her party were going to try and push her for an even harder Brexit. And I think she did make that worse a little bit later on when she started talking about, you know, no deal is better than a bad deal. I think until then, most Brexit ultras hadn't really thought about the possibility seriously that they could get a no deal departure from the European Union, a complete break that many of them were looking for. So in some ways, by uttering that phrase, she probably legitimated their campaign for just such a break. So I don't think she helped herself at all in that respect.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS. You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
And the Conservatives were traditionally very much the party of people like Disraeli, Churchill, Macmillan, and then a big departure, Thatcher. How does Theresa May measure up against them?
Well, I mean, it's interesting. If you, ask what Theresa May's vision of Britain was, you would argue that it was, relatively speaking, at least in Conservative terms anyway, fairly centrist. Mm-hmm. I mean, her whole thrust when she took over was ending austerity, fixing the burning injustices, as she put it, very much influenced by Nick Timothy, who, you know, was very concerned about, you know, some of the inequalities that we see in British society, the need to move away from a kind of free market fundamentalism that, you know, some people argue had rather dominated the Conservative Party since Margaret Thatcher, and, you know, hadn't really been adjusted, and perhaps indeed in some ways put on steroids by David Cameron and George Osborne. And yet she became so preoccupied with Brexit, and Brexit, I think, you know, was already beginning to, you know, damage people's confidence in the British economy, that there just wasn't the kind of growth there in the economy, nor indeed the mindset in Number 10 to actually, you know, tackle some of the issues that she talked about. So there was an extent to which she'd overpromised in that general election campaign, and indeed in her leadership campaign, and couldn't possibly deliver some of the, you know, the rather more kind of centrist public service stuff that many voters thought they were going to get from her. So, you know, that was doubly problematic in some ways.
And some of her closest supporters, people like Damian Green and Gavin Barwell, people on the centrist or even One Nation wing of the Tories, but that didn't seem to really be representative of where the parliamentary party was at the time, the MPs she had to work with.
No, I think you're quite right. I mean, I think, you know, Nick Timothy, you know, who, as I say, was to some extent her, you know, biggest influence and, you know, her guru, although you might laugh at me saying that, you know, was not where most Conservative MPs are, I mean, or were. I think it's fair to say, you know, putting it bluntly, that most Conservative MPs are still bog standard Thatcherites. You know, some of them are more fiscally conservative than others. Some of them are more radical than others. And, you know, you have this difference now between Rishi Sunak, if you like, and Liz Truss, I think, who personify those two wings. But nevertheless, there are two sides of the same Thatcherite coin. And that's definitely where the bulk of the Conservative Party is, at least in terms of its views on the economy. I mean, I think, you know, there are quite big differences between Conservative MPs when it comes to social issues or, you know, moral concerns. But I think when it comes to the economy, they're all pretty much united, and they really don't want a bigger state. They really don't want, you know, more spending, and they really do want tax cuts whenever possible.
And something you touched on at the outset were some of these characters, shall we say, in her cabinet who really wanted her job. She did have a cabinet that were really at each other's throats. I mean, why do you think that was, more so than many other cabinets?
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, she did get rid of a lot of people when she first came in. So I think she, you know, she almost got rid of half of the cabinet and put in either people she felt that she could trust or people that she wanted, not to put too fine a point on it, pissing out of the tent rather than pissing in. And you know, we would obviously include Boris Johnson in that respect. There wasn't room for Michael Gove at first, but in the end, he was tempted back. I mean, I think, you know, why they were at odds with each other was because, A, they had very different visions of what Brexit should be. So if you take someone like Philip Hammond, the Chancellor, he was really all about minimizing the damage of Brexit as far as he was concerned. And there were other members of the cabinet who, you know, were very much in line with his thinking on that. And then you had other members of the cabinet, you know, people like David Davis, people like Boris Johnson, most obviously, who, you know, actually did seriously think of Brexit as a major opportunity that needed to be grasped. So there was a kind of ideological divide there. And then when you combine that clearly with the leadership ambitions, particularly obviously of Boris Johnson, I think that did radically destabilize the government. And of course, once Boris Johnson actually left the cabinet after the Chequers summit, you really had a kind of ongoing and concerted attempt by Johnson and, you know, those around him to destabilize May and eventually to push her out, led in part by the ARG.
On those attempts, actually, how damaging do you think the attempted coups were? Because she did survive a vote of no confidence, just like Boris Johnson did after her, but it did seem to only show that her time was up.
Yes, I think that's right. I mean, it's interesting. She did survive, that confidence vote, but mainly, I think, because many Conservative MPs were rather alarmed about the alternative, and the alternative at that time was Boris Johnson. They hadn't really got to the point of desperation, which they later reached in the spring and summer of 2019, where, he became really, the kind of break glass in case of emergency candidate. They just couldn't see any other way out other than Boris Johnson. So despite their reservations, they decided that May would have to go. But of course, the fact that, she didn't really have much support and was there faute de mieux, she was there simply because they didn't want Johnson at that time, I think, made it very, very difficult for her. And people were just thinking, this obviously included the EU to some extent as well, and indeed the Labour Party. And that made them, I think, even less inclined to do a deal with her than would otherwise been the case. They were all thinking that Theresa May would eventually be replaced. So why actually help her out of the situation she was in? Because, there was no guarantee that anything you agreed with her would eventually come to pass, simply because the Tory party was about to supposedly get rid of her.
What do you think Theresa May's legacy will be? Because I remember a Private Eye front cover which listed her achievements in full, and it was a blank sheet of paper. But even with all the chaos, she did get some important reforms through, like anti-domestic violence legislation. I mean, what do you think we'll remember her for?
Yeah, I mean, she does have a record that she can, to some extent, be proud of. As you say, on domestic violence, on modern slavery, for example. You can argue, there was a long-term plan for the NHS, which was introduced under her, although that's been revised pretty quickly. So she could point to that as well. I mean, Gavin Barwell's book's very interesting on this. There were plans, but, they all really just collapsed in the face of Brexit, which, blotted out the sun in a way. And by the time it came to Theresa May's departure, when she knew she was going, she couldn't really convince any of her colleagues to back some of the things that she wanted to do, simply because they knew that someone else was coming in. And, they didn't necessarily want to spend money on things that might well be reversed. And Philip Hammond is a very good example of that.
One last thing I'd like to suggest is that how we remember a prime minister is often forged by their time as an ex-prime minister. John Major and Gordon Brown, for instance, have both had their standing hugely improved in their time since they've left office, while David Cameron looks rather shiftier than ever after the Greensill scandal. What kind of an ex-prime minister has Theresa May been?
Well, I mean, she's become almost famous now for, making some very tart observations on government policy, across a whole range of subjects. She is listened to by Conservative MPs and indeed MPs across the House, and listened to by people who cover politics as well. She is taken seriously. In part, I think, because she hasn't simply departed the stage and gone off to, earn lots of money, although she has actually made quite a lot of money from speaking engagements, which many people forget, and would perhaps come as a surprise to people who remember some of her performances at Conservative Party conferences.
So did John Major.
Yes, that's right. And I do think she's garnered a certain amount of respect for not running off and, going and doing something else. It's very noticeable, however, that though she is actually willing to wound, she's not willing to kill, in the sense that although she makes criticisms of government policy, she hasn't yet, I think, voted against the government in the lobbies. She hasn't, as it were, put her vote where her mouth is. So although her interventions, I think, have been quite powerful, they possibly aren't quite as powerful as they might be if she were actually to trot into the opposition lobby now and then. But that is something that, as a tribal conservative and someone obviously who, resented the fact that many people were so disloyal to her, it's not something I think we will expect or could expect Theresa May to do.
Well, thank you, Tim. It's been fascinating as ever. And if we hadn't come up to time, I'd have happily gone on for an hour or two. Tim's book, The Conservative Party After Brexit, Turmoil and Transformation, is a rollicking read on the last few years of madness. Dear listeners, thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with another edition. And if you enjoy the podcast, remember, you can support us on Patreon from just £3 a month. You'll be supporting our ever-expanding catalogue of shows like The Bunker, Oh God, What Now?, Origin Story, Arthur Snell's Doomsday Watch, and our latest edition, Paper Cuts. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
Hello, I'm Ros Taylor with news of Oh God, What Now?, the politics podcast that's never going to leave its voter ID at home. On Friday's show, it's 6 months until the US election and Donald Trump is stuck sitting on trial in a New York courthouse. Is he bulletproof or can Joe Biden turn around the polls? In the second half, it's local elections week, but we've steadily taken power away from local authorities. What if we gave it back? And in the extra bit for supporters, is there a right level of ruthlessness in politics? That's Oh God, What Now? With me, Ros Taylor, Raphael Baer, Hannah Fern, guest Nikki McCann Ramirez, out now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Bunker Daily was written and presented by Seth Tavo. The producer was Chris Jones, with audio production by me, Jade Bailey. The managing editor is Jacob Jarvis, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison. With music by Kenny Dickinson and artwork by James Parrott, The Bunker is a Podmasters production.